Matthew 18. Technically, we covered this in 5 minutes last week. But that was too fast. That's my opinion. Maybe it was too slow, in your opinion. Matthew 18. A couple things about this. First of all, Luke 9 and Mark 9 are the parallel accounts. We're basically going to do the same thing we did last week, but a little bit slower, okay? Luke 9, to understand what's going on in this whole section, you got to start with Luke 9. Or it really helps to have started with Luke 9. Luke 9, verse 46. An argument started among them as to which one of them might be the greatest. Some of your words will, some of your versions will have a discussion, not a discussion, a dispute. The idea is still there. This is more than just a casual conversation. This has been elevated to something more than that. My version, the New American Standard, says an argument. That's the idea, dispute, whatever. And this is of the disciples. An argument started among them, the disciples, as to which one of them might be the greatest. Could you imagine? You know, is Steve greater than John is in his faith? Is Gary greater than Ryan is? You could go on down. This is what they're having. Is somebody? No, I'm the greatest. I've got the best faith, or somebody else does. Whatever the case might be. So back in Matthew 18. The first thing Jesus does is he addresses their pride. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" You know, they're thinking, well, you know, we can argue about this all day long. I think I'm better than you. You think you're better than he is. But let's just go to the one who can really tell us. And let's settle the matter right now. He called to himself and set before them a child and said, "Truly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Here's the answer. The first was a warning. This is the answer. The answer is, look, you're wondering who the greatest is. The greatest is the one who humbles himself. They're arguing about who's the greatest, and he's saying, man, you guys are approaching this the wrong way. Remember Matthew chapter 5, the very first beatitude. Beatitude. It's not a biblical word, but the very first one. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Here it is again. In fact, before we move on from this thought, love, do you remember the great passage about love often read at weddings? Where is it? 1 Corinthians 13. That's right. Love is patient, love is kind, love is not jealous. My version says, love does not brag and is not arrogant. That's love. And here, these people have missed the boat. However, let's be sure that none of us missed the boat. Love is not, does not brag. Love is not arrogant. So, there's his answer. Now, we'll go on just a bit. Verses 5 through 20, Jesus addresses his disciples' position. Remember, he had already said to them, unless you become converted, you're not going to get into the kingdom. That's a warning. He's talking about their very position. Look, you guys have got to change. He's going to go back to that now. Look in Mark 9. The other parallel account. Now, while you're turning to Mark 9, in Matthew, he's about to go on to say, woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. If your hand or foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. Remember, that's the passage. Well, in Mark chapter 9, look in verse 42. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe to stumble, it'll be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung. It's the same context. Look how he ends this discussion. Verse 50, salt is good, but if the salt becomes unsalty, with what will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves, and here's the application. Be at peace with one another. My point in going here is that he is still talking about the very same thing as we go on in Matthew. The context that you look at it and you say, well, these are individual all broken up. No, it's still the same conversation he's having. So back in Matthew 9, 18. You can turn to Matthew 9 if you'd like, but that won't help you very much for our conversation. Verses 5 through 10, the importance of not putting temptation in front of brethren. Okay? Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Understand this. He's looking at the child, and he's saying, you've got to become like the child. From here on out, he'll talk about the child, but he's actually talking about them, the disciples, grown-ups, we'll say. Whoever receives one such child, yes, a little child, but that's not really what he's talking about. He's talking about a disciple, one who is humble. Whoever receives one such humble person in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. This is the application. The little one, the child, is another disciple. The one who receives is the opposite of one who causes to stumble. Okay? So, to stumble is to reject. To receive is not to cause to stumble, to flip this around a little bit, okay? Whoever receives such a one in my name receives me, but whoever calls one of these little ones to stumble, who believes in me, to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. In other words, you all were just arguing about who is the greatest. And what happened? One person started it. I'm the greatest. Or Joe's the... Not Joe. There were no Joes. But in our context, John's the greatest. I think John's got more faith than Ryan does. Ryan just, you know, his hair on the back of his neck just stood up a little bit. And what I've done, what somebody's done in this situation, is put a stumbling block in front of the other person. Oh, wait a minute. What's wrong with my faith? I've got good faith. Okay. Verse 7, woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks. It is inevitable that some stumbling blocks will come, but woe to that man through whom stumbling blocks come. If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands or two feet and be cast into eternal fire. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be cast into the fiery hell. See to it that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I say to you that their angels in heaven continually see my the face of my Father who is in heaven. Remember in Mark's, when he gets to the end here, he says, you all be at peace with one another. Stop this arguing. Here he's saying, see to you do not despise one another. Don't put the stumbling block in front of each other. You guys all get along and stop thinking so highly of yourselves or of somebody else, whatever, however it was going on. Now, he'll next address the importance of each individual saint, okay? Verse 11. Here's a statement of the purpose of Jesus. The Son of Man has come to save that which is lost. Okay, you all, stop arguing. Stop putting stumbling blocks in front of one another. Why? Because Jesus came to save every single one of you, and when you put a stumbling block in front of somebody, you're actually causing them the sin, which is opposed to why Jesus came. Don't do that. You're fighting against Jesus in that situation. Verse 12. Here's a statement of God's perspective of each person. What do you think? If any man, it's an analogy, understand. If any man has 100 sheep, and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountain and go and search for the one that is straying, if it turns out that he finds it? Truly, I say to you, he rejoices over it more than the 99 which have not gone astray. So it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones shall perish. Quit your arguing. Quit putting a stumbling block in front of somebody else, causing them to sin. Why? Because you're fighting against Jesus, and number two, you're fighting against God himself, which is essentially the same thing, right? Now, verse 15 is the application of this analogy. He makes a little twist here, okay? In the analogy, if one man has one sheep that goes away, what does the one man do? He goes looking for that one sheep. He does anything he can to get that one sheep back. In the application, the one sheep that is lost is one who has caused somebody else to stumble. Okay? If your brother sins, insert here, cause somebody else to stumble, or sins in general, but immediately cause somebody else to stumble. That's the context. Go and show him his fault. Hey, look, you caused somebody else to stumble. In this case, maybe even the person who's going them, you caused me to stumble. Go on and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more witnesses, two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth about anything that they may ask, it shall be done for them by my Father who is in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in their midst. Okay, he has now addressed, if somebody has caused somebody else to stumble, and you go to that person, you must go to that person and get that lost sheep back. That's what you're trying to do. Now, the idea was, if somebody comes, if I've been caused to stumble, John causes me to stumble. I go to John. I say, John, you caused me to stumble. John says, I'm sorry. Now, what if John does that once a week? How many times do I have to put up with John sinning against me? That's the Peter question. The question Peter asks next. Peter came and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? And the answer, and Peter says, up to seven times, and that was a lot, right? Seven times. And Jesus says, you're all wrong on this, Peter. You've been wrong all along here. Here's another thing. Jesus said to him, I say to you, not seven times, but up to 70 times seven. And as Rob answered, I think 2 weeks ago or last week, 490 times, right? Verse, and then he tells the story of the two debtors. I'm going to skip to the point of the story. Verse 32, summoning him, his Lord said to him, you wicked slave, I forgave you all the debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave? In the same way, I had mercy on you. You should have forgiven him, is the point. And his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed him. My Father and my Heavenly Father will also do the same to you. Here you go, Peter. Here's the question, the answer. If each of you does not forgive his brother from his heart. Okay, that has been an exposition of the passage, how it all fits together. Comments, questions on this? John.
On this right here, or going back to the chapter?
Anything,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. The idea of who is the greatest. This is pretty close to right after the Transfiguration. Mm-hmm. And Jesus didn't choose 12 to go up with him. He only chose three. And we kind of, in some ways, we recognize those three as maybe being first among the apostles a little bit, or maybe we have that
a little greater
when we think about them, maybe a little bit greater than anything else. I'm wondering, do we play into this failure in logic when we recognize those three, or are we just recognizing there seems to have been some sort of special trust that he put in those three?
Yeah, I don't know. I know that there is a tendency for him to have loved more. Now, just because you love one person more doesn't mean you should think that they are a better disciple, a greater disciple. I think there's a failure in the logic. That's my conclusion.
On our part.
Yeah. I could be wrong on that. It may be another comment or question. Last week, I think on my questions, I asked applications. You know, you outlined it. See what you come up with, and observations and applications. I hope you brought your papers from last week. I'm sorry, I should have warned you of that last week. Anybody, come up with John. You've got something open there. Gary, Tanya, go ahead. I didn't miss you this time. Notice.
I had a couple of things about this new one. Some people may know some of the same things, but one thing, getting rid of or distancing yourself from those things that cause you to sin.
Yeah, excellent point. Hebrews, if I can add to it, just or say the same thing. Hebrews chapter 12, lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Yeah, excellent, excellent point. Anybody else, something? Gary?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you have others.
I don't see anybody right now. Go ahead.
Well, this certainly is a passage on self-examination. Mm. I mean, you know, God says, you know, in the perspective here, you know, don't cause someone else, be humble, that's self-examination. Don't cause someone else self-examination. How important is every soul in God's eye? You know, realize that. We need to realize that, how important they are. And that we have that forgiving spirit in our heart. That is essential. That's self-examination. I mean, this takes a great deal of self-examination in our part.
Yeah. Yeah, we look at ourselves in the mirror.
Right.
James 1, other places, the mirror of the word, we examine ourselves. Oh, I've got a problem here, I've got a problem there, I've got too many problems, I don't want to look at the mirror. Never stop looking at the mirror. Once you do that, you've failed. Also, examining ourselves, but how do we know another person's stumbling block unless we
know them?
Yeah. So, do we get to know each other Sunday from 10 to 12, 15? Do we get to know each other's stumbling blocks? Not really. So the implication is, these people are spending time together. God's disciples spend time with one another. And obviously, other than just the times we assemble. Ryan, did you have your hand up?
I was just going to say, it's interesting, in verse 17, Jesus used the word church, even though that, you know, at the time, you know, wasn't, it says, application for us is to, you know, what to do with, like, our brother saying or something.
Yeah. So, Ryan's, to elaborate, he's saying, look, this is the word church here, although the church didn't exist at this time, so obviously these are instructions for the church, which is us, right? So if there's somebody who's in sin, we can go to this passage and say, hey, what do we do? What do we do? Here's a guiding passage for us. Any other comments? Did you?
This first part again, kind of... In terms of application, you asked about application.
Mm-hmm.
Every month when I had the schedule and sat down and did the schedule that we've got up here of who's going to serve in the assembly and everything else, I kind of struggle with this idea of how do you get everybody who wants to be involved in a somewhat equitable basis and back and forth to the point of counting the number of times someone shows up so that there's a sense of fairness and everything else. And part of the other reason that I start with that is that when we first became Christians, I was talking to a neighbor of the church, and I invited her over, and she wouldn't have anything to do with the church because only men stood up to lead. And I kind of thought, well, this is sort of backwards because the men standing up there to lead are performing acts of service.
Yes.
Not lording it over who is still sitting in the assembly, but it was such a different perspective that I just kind of almost didn't even know how to respond because it was just so far out of what the real intention of the thing was. But she saw it as a force of oppression. It's like, okay, well, it's just not what you can.
Yeah, that takes time.
Yeah.
Now you meant there's the church assembled at a certain place and somebody lived by there?
Yes, right next to it.
Okay. You will not enter the kingdom of heaven.
That's right.
I'm getting clearer than that.
That's right.
Couple thoughts. You can keep on commenting on whatever you'd like. Expect disappointment. Disciples are human too. That's what we see here, these disciples. I mean, you rack your brains. How in the world, especially in the presence of God Himself incarnate on earth, and these people are arguing, but if they can do it with God right there, then when I can't see God, how much easier is it for me to think, oh, you know, whatever I think. Disciples are human too, so expect it. And the same thing, expect the unexpected. The unexpected shouldn't be unexpected. This problem came from within, didn't it? What's the expression? You too, Brute? You too, Brutus? Tanya. Yeah.
In that man, because we're all gonna make mistakes, because we're not perfect, you know. But we strive to be there. That's why we should look to God.
Excellent point.
Than man.
That's right. Yeah, we all come to. We're a bunch of losers. Yeah, we're a bunch of disappointing people. The only thing that holds us together is God and our commitment to Him.
Yeah, and to go with that. Oftentimes the world views, I'll use quote unquote church going people, as they think they're better than everyone else. Mm. That's not the case. We come here because we are sinners. We're looking for help from God. You know, this is the hospital. You know, we can come from God.
The true attitude of the Christian is not that we're better, but we're like Paul. Yeah. I am the worst, wretched man that I am. Expect to be patient. Some brethren are repeat offenders, right? That's what Peter had to deal with there. You know, if my brother comes to me, how many times? That's you again? Yes. I am sorry. And expect to need reminders. Jesus had already taught them about, blessed are the poor in spirit. This happened, what, a year and a half, 2 years beforehand? We need these reminders. We need to go back, study our Bible. Once you've read it through, guess what? You're not done. Go back and read it again. A couple observations from this. Where two or three have gathered together in my name, I am there in your midst. I have always heard that, I have very frequently heard that, in reference to the church assembled. Yes, but for worship, really. But the context is, when you are thinking about and executing discipline, or trying to get a brother back, but it ends up in discipline, go to the church and let him be a tax gatherer to you. Whatever you decide, whatever you bind shall have been bound in heaven. Whatever you decide in this matter, what does he say? My Father, for where two or three have gathered together in my name, in my authority, I am there in your midst. This is, hey, you know, you're going to go through some tough times. You're going to be dealing with situations that are foggy, and you don't know what to do, and situations that involve a brother, a sister that you love so much, what do? Jesus understands. Jesus has given us direction, and as long as we follow it to the best of our ability, He'll be right there with us. That's really the point of this. And then, if your brother sins, first go alone to him, then bring somebody else, then inform the whole church. I obviously paraphrase there. That is not a hard and fast set procedure. In Galatians 2, what did Paul do to Peter? And where?
Rebuked him in front of the assembly.
In front of the assembly. Now, one of two things happened. Either Paul first went to him alone, and he rejected it, Peter rejected it, and Paul then went a second time to Peter with somebody else, and Peter again rejected it. Then Paul stood up in the church finally, and addressed Peter, and Peter accepted it. Either that happened, or Paul didn't do this. Which is more reasonable? The same with 1 Corinthians. The next time you are assembled, now they may have approached him, they may have not, but Paul says, the next time you're assembled, number one, I already have decided to judge this one. Next time you're assembled, as though I were there in your presence, you go ahead and you act on this. So it's not always, I'm not trying to rush us to judgment, but at the same time, I'm trying to say this is not a hard and fast rule. There are some times where you find out about the sin, and bam, you take care of it right there and then to the best of your ability. Comments or questions on that?
It does seem to start off as more of a private matter. In verse 15, brother sins against you.
Yours has against you.
Okay.
Yeah, mine does too. No, mine doesn't. Mine has it in a footnote. That may or may not have been added. But I anticipate it. Yes, I agree. In the context, it seems to be very personal. But at the same time, how many versions, what does the King James say?
Same as John.
Against you. Okay. Not all of them do. Not sure what to do with that, you know. General principle here. That's, again, it's a general principle.
Right.
Gary, sorry.
you know, there are different situations that are that are going to call for different, if you say, procedures.
Yeah.
Paul knew that Peter knew.
Yeah. Right.
He knew. I mean, these are inspired apostles. He knew that Peter knew. And that was the situation that Paul felt was best to have him right there. Now, if a weaker brother has sinned against you, you're not going to stand in front of the assembly because you're going to discourage that person of the unbelief.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's different situations.
This says, show him his fault.
Right.
He apparently didn't get that he was in fault. John had something to say. John.
I was going to say, both of those two examples are almost public. Because when
1 Corinthians and Galatians.
With Peter, there was a lot of Hebrews following what Peter said and his actions. So they were in fault too. And the best thing to do would have been do it in a public thing. That way they're all rebuked at the same time to say, hey, it doesn't matter how important you are. If you do this, you're wrong.
Yeah, they're all following him. Or many of them were following him. Yeah.
And with the second one, as we said earlier, everybody looks at the church pretty closely outside the world thinking we're perfect. And they saw exactly what was happening. You know?
Yeah, excellent point. We are God's representatives. And if we don't act right, in fact, if we accept something wrong, then we become a derision in the world, like we read in Exodus 32. Go ahead.
I had put down my thing that God had given us the abilities to work these things out. And so as we have a pattern here, and it also goes, I think, to show, along with what Paul had written, that, you know, he had heard that people were dragging each other into the courts to work these things out. He's like,
yep.
Weren't you given these abilities to essentially work these things out amongst yourselves?
Yeah, great point. Moving on, just a moment. This is, I say the golden, what's the golden rule? Do unto others as you'd have, how appropriate. This is one of these passages where if you can figure this out, then you've got life, you've understood life, okay? There are a couple other passages that come to mind immediately. Number one, we live in two worlds. Ephesians chapter 6, our fight is not against flesh. We live in a spiritual world. It's hard, we got to get that in our minds. We live in two worlds, number one. Number two, the purpose of our life is to find Jesus. Acts 17. He put us here so that we would seek Him. Okay. This is another, there are others. This is another one. Look. Verse 14, I'll just read that. It is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. And the whole context is, so you be careful how you act toward everybody else. That is the whole context here, as we discussed last week. Romans chapter 14. What's Romans 14 about? Yes. One person can do one thing because they have certain knowledge, and they can.
It's the eating things on certain days.
Right. You know, what should we do, what should we not do, and somebody else doesn't have the same knowledge. We don't even have to understand all of Romans 14 to get the major point. Romans 14, look in verse 16. Do not let, or verse 15, if because of food your brother is hurt, you are no longer walking according to love, do not destroy with your food him for whom Christ died. It's the exact same point. It's a different application, but the exact same point. Look, you're putting a stumbling block in front of this person, and Jesus died for him. Same point. 1 Corinthians chapter 8.
And keep going.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
14, 17.
Yep.
For God is not food and drink.
That's right.
Righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit.
Right.
That's the point here. The kingdom of God is not eating and drinking. It's peace, joy, and the Holy Spirit.
Right. Spiritual things. Building up spiritually. In fact, while we're keeping going here, look in verse 15. We'll come back to this. Chapter 15, verse 1. Context. Same context. We who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of those who are without strength, and not just please ourselves. That is the issue. Go ahead. Yeah, oh, you should not take it lightly. Yeah, that's exactly right. This is, like I say, this is a key passage in understanding who we are and what we do and how we interact. 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Now, verse 11. Again, you don't even have to understand the whole context. Just understand this one verse. Through your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined, the brother for whose sake Christ died. Verse 13. Therefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause my brother to stumble. Paul had it figured out. He'll go on to say in the next two chapters, for the weak I became weak. When you are in Rome, do as the Romans, okay? Paul's version of it is, when I'm around people who are going to stumble, I don't ever do what will cause them to stumble. Here are a couple applications. Any comment or question, please raise your hand. If you have any idea what I'm saying here is, in Matthew 18, they said, I'm better, you're better. They were comparing themselves. And what happened? They aroused pride. Don't do it. Don't do it. I can beat up you. My dad can beat up your dad. Joke? No. Don't do it. Because somebody will take it seriously, right? And then association with false religion, traditions, that's what we see here. We didn't really cover it very well because of time. But what happens is somebody who doesn't know that they can do something in this situation and in the next, same situation in the next, they don't know that they can do something when they actually can. They go ahead and do it, not knowing that they can do it. They've sinned because they have gone against their own conscience. They didn't think they could. They didn't know they could, but they went ahead and did it. Also, less than over the top, that's a pun there, modestly attired. Okay? If you're not, you know, some people, how modest are you going to dress? This is modest. Thank you. Number one. Number two. That might not be the issue. That might not be, it is the issue. It might not be enough. Over the top. How modest are you going to dress today? I'm going to dress so modest that nobody can tell if I'm a guy or a girl walking down the street. That might be what's going on here. That might be the solution. Ryan pointed it out 2 weeks ago that the attitude is, I will do anything I possibly can not to cause in any situation, no matter what it is. Here's just one. Our modest or immodest dress. I'm going to dress so conservatively that my brother or my sister is not going to be caused to lust. Consider this. She or he should control his or her mind. True?
Yes. True.
Yes.
Do you want that millstone hung on your neck?
Sorry?
But do you want that millstone hung on your neck?
That's right. The same thing could be said of pride. I'm better than you are. Control your mind. Yes. Now think of this. This is an argument from the lesser to the greater. If it applies in pride, yes, you should control your mind, but at the same time, I'm going to do anything I can not to put a stumbling block in front of you. If it applies in prideful situations, arousing pride, then how much more in arousing lust? Yes, they should control their minds, but at the same time, and by the way, what did Romans 15 say, we who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of those who are without strength, that's it, and not just please ourselves. Why would you do this thing that you don't have to do unless it's just to please yourself? That's the issue at heart here. Any other comments or questions here? Okay, we'll go on. Back in, we're getting to this week's text. We have our questions and our answers. I'm only going to ask three of the questions from this text. Unless somebody has a question about the questions or a comment about the questions. Okay, John 7 is where we are. You can turn there if you want to in the meantime. Question number one. Count how many times kill, hate, fear, seize, or something else is used about Jesus. They wanted to kill Jesus. They were angry with Jesus. They hated Jesus. Anything like that. Count them. Anybody come up with a number?
More than 10.
Huh?
More than 10.
I counted 10.
Did you have your hand up? Okay. All right. You counted 10. Yeah, it depends on which words you included. More than 10 times. Okay, question number 3. What was happening among the crowds? Note this throughout the text. What was happening? Anybody?
some were thinking what he said was good, and others were thinking that he might have been deceiving.
Some were thinking he was good. Some were thinking he was being deceiving. If you could throw a number on there, and I know this is not from the inspired text, or a quantity, how many thought he was good?
Fewer than what was
told. Okay. But in either case, it seems like there was a lot of people saying he's good and even more people saying he was bad. There's general chaos and confusion is really what's going on here. And then question six, the second part. What did Jesus say about the timing of his coming death? Anyone?
A little while.
A little while. Okay. Unless you have a comment or question about the question, so I'm going to pass on those. All right, let's review real quick. In all of our year-long study, by the way, we've just entered the halfway point of our study of the Gospels, life of Christ, just in these last few sentences, asking those questions. Okay, in our study, we've been studying what has happened again. Let's review. Just recently, the apostles have said, "You're the Messiah. You're the Christ." They've worshipped him. They have said, "We won't leave you," despite the fact that everybody else is. And then there's a somewhat of a transition. Jesus starts training them. They see the transfiguration. Wow. They're told about the church and that they would have authority. That's something new. You yourselves are going to have authority from me. So they're really getting a lot here. Look in chapter 7, verse 2. The feast of the Jews, the feast of booths, was near. That's approximately 6 months before the Passover. So we've got 6 months left here. We're narrowing it down. Verse 1. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. We have read before that the Jews were seeking to kill him, but not like this. 10 times in this chapter, something. We hate you. We want to kill you. We want to seize you so that we can kill you. 10 times in this chapter alone. The point is we have a marked turn, a marked change of events. Things are going to get worse from here on out. At the same time, at this one feast, there's chaos and confusion. Some thought he was the Savior. Many did not. Some wanted to say something, but they were scared to. Some were questioning those who were in authority. I mean, there's just chaos and confusion going on here. And when there's hate and chaos and confusion, that generally ends in what? Something bad. A murder is going to happen. If you got that, I think you've got the text of John 7, essentially. The main point of it. There are some couple points that we can ping, but that's the main point. Any comment or question on John 7 so far? Okay. Let's just read the first couple verses here. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. The feast of the Jews, the feast of booths, was near. Therefore, his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go into Judea, so that your disciples may also see your works which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers were believing in him. So Jesus said to them, "My time is not here yet, but your time is always opportune. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it, that its deeds are evil. Go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time has not yet fully come." Having said these things to them, he stayed in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up to the feast, he himself went up, not publicly, but as if in secret. A couple things to understand from this. Number one, he said, "I'm not going up," and then he goes up. Is there a contradiction? They were saying, "Go up and show yourself to the world." And he's saying, "I'm not going to go up and show myself to the world. That will happen later." But he did go up privately. No contradiction. Number two, why did the world hate Jesus? Was Jesus politically correct? Not at all. And we cannot be either when it comes to matters of truth. If it's untrue, if it's false, if it's sin, we can be tactful, but we can never be politically correct. We always side with the truth. Here's a couple points. We'll close with these. If you pay attention to apologetics and arguments of skeptics, skeptics say, you can't believe the Bible. One of their arguments is, you can't believe the New Testament authors because they were so biased. They wanted Jesus to be the Messiah. They believed it, so you can't believe them. You ever hear that argument? Maybe, maybe not. This is one of them. How would you address that? You can't believe them because they wanted it to be true.
Well, for one thing, there are those on the other side who were opposed to attest to his existence.
Okay. Yes, yes, okay. And you're talking about probably secular writers?
Yeah.
Okay. Even his brothers. His brothers didn't believe him. What happened to two of his brothers, at least two, James and Jude, became believers. So, if you can find somebody who was, in fact, it's not like they were indifferent either. They did not believe him, and they became believers. So, if you can't believe somebody because they always believed him, can you believe somebody if they changed? And at the same time, if I told you that I have $1 million in my bank account, and I actually did, I don't. But if I told you I did, and I actually did, and I really wanted it, could you believe me? If I did have $1 million, yes. So wanting to believe something doesn't have anything to do with whether or not it's actually true. I want to be alive this afternoon. Later on this afternoon, if I'm still alive, will it be true? It has nothing to do with what you want. We'll stop there, and we'll break till 5 after.